Well, this has been a week. I don't ever want to go through a week like this again, to be honest with you. Just to give you some lowlights, I was served in two lawsuits at my business this week that I didn't expect. Not that lawsuits are good when you expect them, but they're worse when you don't. We uncovered some errors that is going to make significant financial impact. We had two people resign. I had one because of all this that happened, was hospitalized due to stress-related illness. I had another employee out because of emergency surgery that his wife had. And all of this was just work. Then on Wednesday morning at 4 o'clock, my son calls me and tells me that my granddaughter, one-year-old granddaughter, is having seizures and she's being taken by the paramedics to the hospital. And she had a seizure that lasted over an hour, so for 3 days this week, my granddaughter was in the hospital doing various tests of poking with needles and all these things. And thankfully, she is back home and she's doing well. And for those of you who prayed for us, I am indebted to you. Thank you for that. That was wonderful. And if that wasn't enough, on Thursday morning, driving to work, I get a call from the son of a good friend of mine, and he told me that on Thursday night, his dad passed away. As I thought about this week, I began to think about the life of my friend Sandy Fairchild, and I thought that every time that you saw him and you asked him how he was, he never drew attention to himself. He would always answer the same way. He always answered, "I am praising my Lord," every time. And I believe that because of that statement that he always made every time you asked him how he was, I will believe that will be his epitaph. Sandy Fairchild lived praising his Lord. Now, epitaphs kind of intrigue me. In case you don't know, the literal meaning of the word epitaph is on the gravestone. It is the attempt to look at the entire life of an individual, all he has done, all he has accomplished, and all of his relational efforts, and then using just a handful of words, make a final statement about him, and then carving it in granite. Some of these epitaphs are touching. Here lies Elizabeth, loving mother, loving daughter, loving sister. Or here lies my husband John, my best friend in all the world. Some of these are just factual. On a headstone in Georgia, it says, "I told you I was sick." Or here lies Margaret Daniels. She always said her feet were killing her, but no one would listen. These are actual statements on gravestones. Some make us smile. Here lies John Thurman, an atheist, all dressed up and nowhere to go. Here lies Johnny Yeast. "Pardon me for not rising." You got that? Have you ever thought of the few words that you would be reduced to or your life would be reduced to and what people would say about you if you were not there to correct them? Over the years, I wonder what my wife would have carved in stone about me. I think after the first year of our marriage, it would have been, "Whew, I'm glad that's over." While we were raising kids, it might have been, "Well, at least now I only have three sons to raise, or three boys to raise." You see, we had three boys. I was the fourth. Sorry. I'm not sure what it would be now, but I'm sure that words could not even begin to describe it. Epitaphs fascinate me, not only because it's the last word written in stone, but years from now, as a stranger steps up to or across our headstone, it is all they will ever know about how we lived. Which begs the question, how do you want your epitaph to read? In 1 Samuel chapter 12, we take a look at a man named Samuel. And if you look closely, you will see the summation of his life unfold as he seemingly writes out his epitaph before our very eyes. And if you consider his circumstances, it makes perfect sense that he picks this particular moment to start thinking about how he will be viewed by others around him as he is at the end of his career and near the end of his life. 1 Samuel chapter 12, verse 1. Samuel said to all Israel, I have listened to everything you said to me and have set a king over you. Now you have a king as your leader. As for me, I am old and gray, and my sons are here with you. I have been your leader from my youth until this day. This verse has transition written all through it. He is now at the end of his life. He is old and gray, and he has been the leader until this day. In fact, he had been the leader of Israel all of his life, yet on this day, he was handing it over to another. If you remember back to chapter 1, Samuel's mother had taken him to the temple and presented him to God. So from age 3 or thereabouts, he served God in the temple. He knew of nothing else. He only knew serving God and serving God's people in his role as God-appointed judge and leader over Israel. But a corporate shift is about to take place because the people wanted a change. They no longer wanted a prophet or a priest or a judge that God had chosen for them. They wanted a king. And Samuel, as a servant of the people, says in verse 1, I have listened to everything you said to me and have set a king over you. So near the end of his life, with his position given to another, we begin to consider what would be written about Samuel in his epitaph about how he lived. We may say, Samuel obeyed God. True statement. We may say he was trustworthy with what God gave him. Again, accurate. He didn't run away from responsibility. True. And he put God first. Again, I agree. But I do not think that is what Samuel would want. Because each of those statements say something about Samuel. They draw attention to him, that he obeyed God, that he was trustworthy, that he didn't turn away from responsibility. It was about who he was and what he did, and that is not the way Samuel lived. You know what I think his epitaph would read, or should read? Here lies Samuel. He lived as if he were transparent. Now, you may think that's a bit of an odd epitaph, especially when we think of something transparent, we think of something that we look into. For instance, when we think of a transparent life, we think of a life that we can see in and see the true motives about the way that person lives. But that is not the best definition of the word transparent. The best definition is to see through, to see beyond, not into. Have you ever stood at the window of a hotel or of your home or any place where there is a beautiful ocean or a beautiful scenery on the other side? And have you ever wished that that window was obscure or so dirty you couldn't see through it? Of course not. Because the window is there for the view. It is not that the window is completely unnoticeable because, as we know, it serves a purpose. It keeps the weather out, and it keeps the noise to a minimum. It keeps the temperature in the room comfortable, no matter what the weather is like outside. But the window is never there to be admired. It is there for the view. And I believe that's the way Samuel desired to live, to be so transparent that whatever he did, God would clearly be seen. I have four reasons it is important to live transparent that we can draw from Samuel's life. And the first is, being transparent is living above reproach. Being transparent is living above reproach. In other words, the window has to be clean. Look at verse 3. Here I stand, this is Samuel speaking, here I stand, testify against me in the presence of the Lord and his anointed, whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Whom have I cheated? Whom have I oppressed? From whose hand have I accepted a bribe to make me shut my eyes? If I have done any of these, I will make it right. In order to get the full impact of this, we have to go back a few chapters to see why he selects stealing and cheating and taking a bribe as important. In chapter 2, we studied Eli and his sons, Hophni and Phinehas. And if you remember, it was the practice of the priests that they would, people would bring the sacrifice, and when they brought the meat sacrifice, they would cut off the fat, and they would burn it up as sacrifice to the Lord. Then they would continue the sacrifice by putting the rest of the meat in a pot and boil it, and the priests were allowed to go in with a three-pronged fork, and whatever came out on the three-pronged fork during the boiling, that was their portion of the sacrifice. But Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, they wanted more. They found out that that wasn't the best cut of meat, so they decided they would take whatever they wanted. So in chapter 2, verse 15, it says this, "Even before the fat was burned, the servant of the priest would come and say to the man who was sacrificing, 'Give the priest some meat to roast. He won't accept boiled meat from you, only raw.' If the man said to him, 'Let the fat be burned up first, then take whatever you want,' the servant would then answer, 'No, hand it over now. If you don't, I'll take it by force.' The sin of the young men was very great in the Lord's sight, for they were treating the Lord's offering with contempt." Eli's sons did the very thing that Samuel was speaking of in verse 3 of chapter 12. They stole from the people of God, they cheated the people, and used them for their own gluttony. But it didn't stop there. Let's look at Samuel's own sons, his heirs. In chapter 8, verse 1, it says this, "When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah. And they served in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, 'You are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have.'" His sons did the same thing. They perverted justice and were dishonest, and they accepted bribes. So it is important to Samuel to ask this question, "Did I ever do the same to any of you? If so, I will make it right today. I stand here in court today in front of all of you as my witnesses. Speak now, what will you say about me when I'm gone?" Let's go back to chapter 12. Before we move to the people's response to Samuel's question, "Have you done any of these things?" we need to pay attention as to who is present at this gathering. Who is witness to what is going on here? Look again at verses 2 and 3 of chapter 12. "Now you have a king as your leader. As for me, I am old and gray, and my sons are here with you. I have been your leader from my youth until this day. Here I stand, testify against me in the presence of the Lord and His anointed. There are five individuals or groups mentioned in these three verses. There is Samuel, who is making the address to the crowd. There is the Lord is present. Saul, who is God's anointed, is present. The crowd that is being addressed, and Samuel's sons, all of these are gathered for Saul's coronation as king. So before the people, on the platform, is Saul and Samuel. But who is not on the platform? Samuel's sons. They are, as it says in the verse, here with you, implying they are not up here with me. You see, the people, the place of leadership was on the platform, but yet the rest of the crowd were those that followed the leadership. I think it's possible after chapter 8, Samuel had removed his sons from responsibility. They were no longer recognized as priests. They were just one of the crowd. They are here with you. I believe it would have been Samuel's dream, just like any father, for his sons to walk in the same way that he walked, to take over the responsibility of the family business by being a priest and a judge. In fact, it said in 8 that he appointed them as judges. But it was clear in chapter 8 that your sons do not walk in your ways. Therefore, they were excluded from taking over the family business. Samuel was saying that day, and maybe a bit with a sad heart, "Before God and before your new king, did I ever live for my own gain? Even when it came to my children, did I ever cheat you from knowing who God really was and being obedient to His word? Did I ever get in the way that you could not see God through me?" That is living above reproach. For Samuel, being transparent was most important. He desired to live without dirt of scandal or anything else that may obscure the purpose of his ministry, because the most important thing to Samuel in his ministry was that the people had a clear view of God and who he was. So what was the people's response to his question? Look at verse 4. You have not cheated or oppressed us, they replied. You have not taken anything from anyone's hand. Samuel said to them, "The Lord is witness against you and also his anointed this day that you have not found anything in my hand. He is witness," the crowd said. Now, why do you think Samuel picked this particular moment at Saul's coronation to make all this fuss about his ministry and whether he had lived above reproach or not? It seems odd until you remember that a transition is about to take place, and in any transition of leadership, what happens? Things change. There's a pendulum swing in any change of leadership that goes from one side to the next, and it's no different in the people of Israel. If you look at their history, they're over and over again, as a leadership would change, the people would either serve God or they would not. And it may sound arrogant on Samuel's part to be drawing attention to himself by pointing out what a good leader he had been. But as we will see in the next few verses, he's not. Instead, he is exposing a reoccurring flaw in Israel's view of God over years and years and generations and generations. Samuel knew by looking back at history, Samuel knew that by looking back at history, they were all about to do the same thing they had done time after time. They were about to forget the Lord their God and follow another. The second reason is important to be transparent is being transparent exposes mankind to the righteousness of God. 1 Samuel chapter, or verse 6 of chapter 12. Then Samuel said to the people, "It is the Lord who appointed Moses and Aaron and brought your forefathers up out of Egypt. Now then, stand here, because I am going to confront you with the evidence before the Lord as to all the righteous acts performed by the Lord for you and your fathers." Now, I want you to notice here that Samuel is about to confront the people. They're about to stand trial, so to speak. But what is fascinating is that he doesn't confront them with the evidence of their mistakes or the things that they had done wrong or their bad choices. Not to say that they haven't made a few, but he doesn't use that to confront them. Nor does he even use himself as an example. What does he do? He confronts them with evidence before the Lord as to the righteous acts performed by the Lord for you and your forefathers. He shows them God, not themselves. He doesn't hold a mirror up and say, "Look at yourselves. Look how dirty you are." He doesn't do that. He shows them God and says, "Look at him. Now compare yourself." Samuel says, "Take a good look at God, at all the righteous acts he has performed, and don't let anything obscure your view. Not yourself, not me, not your new king, not your forefathers, not your sin. I want you to see God and his righteousness." So he begins. Look at verse 8. "After Jacob entered Egypt, they cried to the Lord for help, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your forefathers out of Egypt and settled them in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, so he sold them into the hands of Sisera, the commander of the army of Hazor, and into the hands of the Philistines and the king of Moab, who fought against them. They cried out to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned, we have forsaken the Lord and served the Baals and Ashtoreths. But now deliver us from the hands of our enemies and we will serve you.' Then the Lord sent Jerubbaal, Barak, Jephthah, and Samuel. And he delivered you from the hands of your enemies on every side so that you lived securely." Samuel is giving them a little history lesson here as recorded in the book of Judges. And if you will just take a minute to turn back two books, Ruth and then to Judges, I want us to read together about this history lesson that he's given them. As we have said before, Samuel was the last judge of the people of Israel. There were several judges before him. And these judges had a significant role in the leadership of Israel. I want you to look at chapter 2 of Judges and look at verse 16 with me. And I want you to look at this back and forth pendulum swing that he begins to show us. Chapter 2, verse 16. "Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders," or their enemies. "Yet they would not listen to their judges, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshiped them. Unlike their fathers, they quickly turned away in which their fathers walked, the way of obedience to the Lord's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for them, he was with the judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. For the Lord had compassion on them as they groaned under those who oppressed and afflicted them. But when the judge died, the people returned to the ways even more corrupt than those of their fathers, following other gods and serving and worshiping them. They refused to give up their evil practices and stubborn ways." Samuel, being the last judge, knew the history, and he knew what happened when judges died. Time and time again, this was the pattern. And he shows them the pattern. In Judges chapter 3, because the people had turned away from God, he allowed them to be captured by the Moabites. And when they cried out to God, God sent Ehud to kill the king of the Moabites. God disciplined them, and then he delivered them. Both of those things, both the discipline and the deliverance, was the righteous acts of God that he was talking about in 1 Samuel chapter 12. When Ehud died, they quickly turned their back on God, and in Judges 4, we read about Sisera, who was the commander of the army of the king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And there it says that they cruelly oppressed the Israelites for 20 years until they finally cried out to God. Enter Barak, who led the Lord's army, and he routed Sisera. And all the troops of Sisera fell by the sword, and not a man was left. God intervened. Again, discipline, and then deliverance by God, the righteous acts of God. Then Barak dies, and in chapter 6 of Judges, we read once again that Israel turned away from God and were sent under the oppression of the Midianites. And after 7 years, they cried out to the Lord for help. And God called upon Jerubbaal, another name for Gideon, and with a few men and some clay pots and trumpets and torches, God delivered them. Discipline and deliverance, the righteous acts of God. But Samuel doesn't stop with what happened to just their ancestors and judges. He brings it to the present day. He reminds them of what God did for them in chapter 7 of 1 Samuel. Remember, he says, not long ago you were oppressed by the Philistines because you had turned away from God and you were worshiping other idols. And when the people repented and when they turned back to God, they removed their idols and God thundered against your enemies and you barely had to raise a hand. Each time, God disciplined them for their disobedience, and each time, God rescued them, and he delivered them when they turned to him. The righteous acts of God. And now Samuel says the scariest thing in this chapter. Pay attention, because you're about to do it again. Verse 12 of chapter 12. But when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, was moving against you, you said to me, no, we want a king to rule over us, even though the Lord your God was your king. Now here is the king you have chosen, the one you asked for. See, the Lord has set a king over you. I don't know about you, but that had to be a very awkward moment at this coronation. The new king is standing on the platform, but Samuel stands up and he says, you have rejected the true king, but you got a substitute. He's right here. God was your king. Now you're putting something obscure between you and him again, and you're demanding your own way, and the crazy cycle is about to begin again. Samuel is giving them the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. Now, before I get to my third point, I want to interject something here. Because some of you may be looking at this and saying, and it's difficult for us to see, what's the big deal about this change in leadership? What is such a difference between the leadership of being a priest and a judge, and why can't we call him a king? Isn't that just a matter of semantics? Well, I think it's a significant deal. And let's look back at verse 6. Then Samuel said to the people, "It is the Lord who appointed Moses." Verse 8, "And the Lord sent Moses and Aaron." Verse 11, "Then the Lord sent Jerubbaal, Barak, Jephthah, and Samuel." Now compare that to verse 12, where the people say, "No, we want a king. We are not interested in who God sent. We want a king." And in verse 13, "Now here is the king you have chosen, the one you asked for, even though the Lord was your king." A king is a position of authority. It is not a position of a servant or even an appointment. Kings rule, all others submit. You are putting in front of you an obscure window because you are bowing down to a substitute king when the real king was clearly visible. But Samuel, in light of all that, in light of the fact that they rejected God and they have selected a king and they now have a king over them, he points out something that is extremely important, not only for this moment, but for us and for all time. Because not all is lost. The main thing is still the main thing. Samuel calls them to do what God has used prophet and priest and preacher to do for year after year and time after time. He has called the people to serve and obey the Lord only. The third reason is important to be transparent is being transparent spotlights the one and only King. Look at verse 14. "If you fear the Lord and serve and obey Him and do not rebel against His commands, and if both you and the king who reigns over you follow the Lord your God, good. But if you do not obey the Lord, if you rebel against His commands, His hand will be against you as it was against your fathers." I want you to notice, for the very first time, there is an addendum to the command, serve the Lord your God only. Because now, it includes both you and your king. It's not just you anymore. Because as the king goes, so does the people. I believe this is not only a warning to the people of Israel, but also to you and I. Because kings are still important to us. We like to put people in positions of authority. Oh, we may not recognize them in purple robes and on a throne, but we also often place someone between us and God and look for a leader who will lead us instead of diligently seeking God in prayer and the study of His Word on our own. We look for a pastor or a teacher or a Bible study leader or an elder or whatever you want to call them to do all the work for us, to direct us, to tell us which way to go and what to do and what to believe. And here's the thing. If the king or those guys I just listed or that leader follow the word of God and worship Him only, it will be good. But if he doesn't, we will find ourselves in peril and we will be lost. Because as the king goes, so does the people. God is our king. We need to worship and serve Him only. He is all we need. He is sufficient. In verse 16, Samuel is about to prove this very thing. He is about to spotlight the true king, or more accurately, God is about to spotlight himself. And he makes a point right in front of Saul at his coronation as if to say, I will show you who your real king is. So Samuel backs up out of the spotlight and he allows God to show the people and the new king who the real king is. Verse 16. Now then, stand still and see this great thing the Lord is about to do before your eyes. Is it not wheat harvest now? I will call upon the Lord to send thunder and rain, and you will realize what an evil thing you did in the eyes of the Lord when you asked for a king. Then Samuel called upon the Lord, and that same day the Lord sent thunder and rain, so all the people stood in awe of the Lord and of Samuel. Because it was wheat harvest, this sign not only displayed God's power, but also his judgment. Heavy rain at harvest could destroy completely their crops. The sign is a warning that not only was the rain not good at harvest time, but it was also very unusual. This was not only a display of power, like I said, but it is also a warning from God. And not just a warning to the people, but also to the new king. Because God's saying, obey me and serve me only, I mean business. And in verse 19, the people responded. Then all the people said to Samuel, pray to the Lord your God for your servants so that we will not die. For we have added to all of our other sins the evil of asking for a king. Now right here, right at this moment, is living life transparent. Right here is the perfect opportunity for Samuel to step into the limelight. He had an audience. He had them on the edge of their seats. He had thunder and lightning flashing from his fingertips. He could have said right at that moment, you need to reject Saul and follow me because God listens to me. But instead, he steps back. Just as he did when the people wanted a king. Because the only thing that Samuel desired to be etched in stone about his life was to live transparent enough so that only God would be visible. The fourth reason for being transparent is this. Being transparent always brings the glory to another. Look at verse 20. Do not be afraid, Samuel replied. You have done all this evil, yet do not turn away from the Lord, but serve the Lord with all of your heart. Do not turn away after useless idols. They can do you no good, nor can they rescue you because they are useless. Listen to this. For the sake of his great name, the Lord will not reject his people, because the Lord was pleased to make you his own. Being transparent brings glory to another. It is recognizing that you exist to display him and his righteous acts of discipline and deliverance in your life. It is for the sake of his great name, not yours and mine. And listen carefully. He says this to the people of Israel. He also says to us. It's implied in this verse, even if you fail over and over again, it is for the sake of his great name, the Lord will not reject his people. Why? Because the Lord was pleased to make you his own. And no one can take you out of his hand because he made you his own for his name's sake. If you only belong to God because of your efforts or your righteous acts, you would not be worth it. But you don't. You and I belong to God because it pleased Him for His name's sake. Now Samuel closes his coronation starting at verse 23. As for me, far be it from me that I should sin against the Lord by failing to pray for you. And I will teach you the way that is good and right. Be sure to fear the Lord and serve Him faithfully with all your heart. Consider what great things He has done for you. Yet if you persist in doing evil, both you and your king will be swept away. And in chapter 13, verse 1, it starts, Saul was 30 years old when he became king, and Samuel walks out of the spotlight and off the platform. I find these last few verses, this last statement by Samuel, to be a powerful moment for God. He is standing next to the new king, and he finds himself the odd man out. He is standing in front of the people that rejected him after all he had done, even though God reminded him in chapter 8 that it was not him that they were rejecting, it was God they were rejecting, but don't tell me that it still didn't hurt a bit. He was turning over the leadership that he had lived faithful to God all his life, and he was turning it over knowing that full well that disaster was laying in the wings. Yet he deems it a sin if he didn't pray for the new king and the people and continue to teach them the ways of God. Could we do that? Why do I say it's a powerful moment for God? Because this statement by Samuel proved that he lived completely for the display of God. And he would not, I repeat, would not allow his hurt or his disappointment or feeling of mistreatment or betrayal obscure the view of God. As I think about the life of my friend Sandy, that's the way he lived. However he was hurt, you didn't know it. However he was truly feeling on the inside, you seldom could find out. Because when you asked him how he was, he would always answer the same, I am praising my God. And that is why I believe that somewhere on the granite stones of heaven, there is an inscription that reads, Here lives Sandy and Samuel, because they lived as if transparent for my name's sake. Let's pray together. Father, the world that we live in, as you well know, screams at us so that we will be noticed. It demands our time and our attention on us. It wants us to be primary in everything we do. Yet, God, you have called us to be transparent for your name's sake. You have called us to not draw attention to ourselves, and whatever we're going through here, whatever we face, you've asked us to display you. Lord, what a calling that is. Give us the ability and the strength to put you in the primary position in our life, to live in such a way that, Lord, that we would never forget that you are the most important, that you are the king that needs to be spotlighted, that we need to give the glory and honor to another, and we need to live lives above reproach in order to do that. Lord, give us a desire to serve and glorify and honor you by displaying you in our lives. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.